So Genesis 18 through to 19.
Genesis 18. And the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, as he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing in front of him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them, and bowed himself to the earth, and said, O Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought, and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree, while I bring a morsel of bread, that you may refresh yourselves. And after that you may pass on, since you have come to your servant. So they said, Do as you have said. And Abraham went quickly into the tent to Sarah, and said, Quick, three says of fine flour, knead it, and make cakes. And Abraham ran to the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to a young man who prepared it quickly. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set it before them. And he stood by them under the tree while they ate. And they said to him, Where is your Sarah, your wife? And he said, She is in the tent. The Lord said, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. The way of woman had ceased to be with Sarah. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, After I'm worn out, and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure? And the Lord said to Abraham, Why did Sarah laugh and say, Shall I indeed bear a child now that I'm old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son. But Sarah denied it, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. He said, No, but you did laugh. Then the men set out from there, and they looked down towards Sodom. And Abraham went with them to set them on their way. The Lord said, Shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? For I have chosen him, that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. Then the Lord said, Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And if not, I will know. So the men turned from there and went towards Sodom. But Abraham still stood before the Lord. Then Abraham drew near and said, Will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be it that from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? And the Lord said, If I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I will spare the whole place for their sake. Abraham answered and said, Behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord, I who am but dust and ashes. Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Will you destroy the whole city for the lack of 5? And he said, I will not destroy it if I find 45 there. Again he spoke to him and said, Suppose 40 are found there, he answered. For the sake of 40, I will not do it. Then he said, Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose 30 are found there. He answered, I will not do it if I find 30 there. He said, Behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. He answered, For the sake of 20, I will not destroy it. Then he said, Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak again, but this once. Suppose 10 are found there. He answered, For the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. And the Lord went his way when he had finished speaking to Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Chapter 19. The two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed himself with his face to the earth and said, My lords, please turn aside to your servant's house and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise up early and go on your way. They said, No, we will spend the night in the town square. But he pressed them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. But before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people, to the last man, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us, that we may know them." Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after him, and said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Behold, I have two daughters who have not known any man. Let me bring them out to you, and do to them as you please. Only do nothing to these men, for they have come under the shelter of my roof." But they said, "Stand back." And they said, "This fellow came to sojourn, and he has become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them." Then they pressed hard against the man Lot, and drew near to break the door down. But the men reached out their hands and brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck with blindness the men who were at the entrance of the house, both small and great, so that they wore themselves out, groping for the door. Then the men said to Lot, "Have you anyone else here? Sons-in-law, sons, daughters, or anyone you have in the city, bring them out of the place, for we are about to destroy the place, because the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out and said to his sons-in-law, who were met to marry his daughters, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city." But he seemed to his sons-in-law to be jesting. As morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city." But he lingered. So the men seized him and his wife and his two daughters by the hand, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. And as they brought them out, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look back or stop anywhere in the valley. Escape to the hills, lest you be swept away." And Lot said to them, "Oh, no, my lords. Behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have shown me great kindness in saving my life. But I cannot escape to the hills, lest the disaster overtake me and I die. Behold, this city is near enough to flee to, and it's only a little one. Let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my life will be saved." He said to him, "Behold, I grant you this favor also, that I will not overthrow the city of which you have spoken. Escape there quickly, for I can do nothing till you arrive there." Therefore the name of the city was called Zoar. The sun had risen on the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah sulfur and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But Lot's wife behind him looked back, and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he looked, and behold, the smoke of the land went up like a smoke of a furnace. So it was that when God destroyed the cities of the valley, God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had lived.
There are significant things in this passage for us to think about as Christian people and those of us who have questions about the veracity and the validity of Christian faith when we hear things like the Lord destroying an entire city for the sins committed there. I hope I'm able to do this some justice this morning. Listen, have you ever walked in on a conversation partway through and heard some disagreeable detail and then formed some opinions and suspicions about the characters involved? You just hear a little bit of the conversation, you form an opinion, and it's probably the worst opinion that you could possibly form about the situation. I know I have. I've heard little snippets, and then I form an opinion that is not true of the people involved. In fact, not so long ago, I read an article from a British missionary to Africa. And the article started out like this. The missionary wrote, "Last weekend, I hired out some prostitutes for the first time in my life, two young ladies for the whole night." To be honest, as I read that part of the article, the first line, my heart sank a little. I thought I was about to read another confession of another disgraced missionary defaming the good name of Christ. So only one sentence deep into the article, I'm already forming these deep suspicions about what is about to come, who this man was, who this missionary was. But I read on in the story. I read on. And the missionary continued and he said the following. Because I'm a preacher and I didn't want anyone to know what I was doing, I asked a trusted friend to hire these women and bring them to a hotel where I would join them. I sat down and introduced myself. I told them how I wanted them to have a night off. They could order whatever they wanted, enjoy a hot shower, and then have a night of deep rest. The only rule was not to solicit any of the hotel guests. I would be back in the morning to pay them, and after breakfast together, they could go. Morning came, and we met over breakfast. They're both orphans. They have no elder family members to look out for them. Tears came. I told them we had prayed for them. They were totally receptive. We held hands, invited Jesus in to help them make a fresh start. After this encounter, the missionary arranged for them to have counseling, provided them with a home, and found donors to help them through an education. If all I read of that missionary's account was the first sentence and then settled on my first opinions of the man, I would never have learned of the true and good intentions to give two profoundly disadvantaged women a night of sincere rest, free from the misuse of paying customers, and also to offer them tangible support for their future. Such is the problem when we shape our opinions about something or someone on fragments of information, when we make snap judgments without making further inquiry ourselves. Some of our other than Christian neighbors and friends may have shaped their opinions about God on fragments of information and snippets of the Bible. They hear pieces of a story, like the story of Sodom being destroyed, and they suspect that God must be cruel and unpleasant. A case in point, pay attention to these words from a famed atheist, Richard Dawkins, who gave his opinion of the Judeo-Christian God. He writes, "This God is a fiercely unpleasant God, morbidly obsessed with sexual restrictions, with the smell of charred flesh." If all you knew about God were formed or informed by snippets of information, like the story of Sodom, one can understand why people hold deep suspicions about who God is and what He is like. So keep in mind then this morning that many of your other than Christian friends or neighbors do think about God this way. They do consider God to be deeply unpleasant and cruel because of little bits of information they have picked up in their lives. And that being the case, I'd like to propose two things this morning. Firstly, as we consider the destruction of Sodom, let's note that the destruction was preceded by a wider narrative of God taking up the cause of those victimized by sexual violence. And secondly, God's actions towards Sodom are not done in haste or a bloodthirsty zeal for destruction, as some suppose, but after due consideration and after multiple pleas for them to change their ways, God finally acts. In this way, this morning, we can learn how to take up conversation with our other than Christian friends and neighbors who suspect the God we believe in is unpleasant and cruel. What I hope for you this morning is that you will come away with some tools to talk with friends and neighbors who suspect God to be a troublesome character like Richard Dawkins does. So let's begin this morning with the reminder that Sodom's destruction was preceded by a wider narrative of God taking up the cause of those victimized by sexual assault. The city of Sodom had a reputation, and it wasn't a flattering reputation. Earlier on in our series with Abraham, we find out what was widely known about Sodom. When people talked about what it's like to visit Sodom, these are the kinds of things that they said about the place. They said the men of Sodom were wicked and great sinners against the Lord. If you were to look up the city on Trivago in those days, this is the customer review that you would get. And in our passage, we see evidence of this wicked and sinful reputation by looking at the respective ways in which Abraham's guests were treated. Firstly, by the way that the guests were treated by Abraham, and then how the guests were treated by the city of Sodom. Now, before I go any further, some of our friends and neighbors will already discredit the story of Sodom and Gomorrah because of the detail that the Lord appeared and two other characters who are identified as angels. And they say, your Bible sounds like it's produced in the world of Harry Potter or Peter Pan. It just sounds mythical. I don't know if I'm able to offer you a bulletproof answer to that, but can I just ask you to consider, if that is your critique of the Bible, if God really is God, if God exists and the world is his story in which he can do as he pleases, it is not unthinkable that he would insert himself on the pages as he chooses, that he can do as he pleases. He can appear in the human form if he pleases. He can command angels to accompany him in the form of men. That's one conclusion that we draw, because as we notice, the author just simply records that detail as though it's entirely consistent with the rest of the worldview of the Bible. He doesn't need to qualify it, because the worldview of the Bible is completely compatible with that idea that God can insert himself where he pleases. What I mainly want to point out, though, is these contrasting way in which these visitors, the Lord and the two angels, were treated, firstly by Abraham and then by Sodom. Abraham honored these guests with kind and respectful hospitality, right? He makes them food. He gets his best meat out to have it prepared for them. He offers them rest, water. He gives them all the hospitality and kindness that he has to offer. Sodom, on the other hand, offers no such honorable hospitality. Instead, the men of the city insisted on gang raping the guests. The contrast in the treatment is supposed to shock us. We are supposed to be horrified that in the space of 24 hours, the men could receive such gracious hospitality from one and then be faced with violation in another city. It's meant to shock us, and it also affirms for us the reputation that Sodom had. That if you were a male visitor that was visiting that city, you were likely to be sexually violated. That is the reputation of Sodom. And if that is the case, if that is what Sodom was like, if this is what they were widely known for, You can imagine for yourself the litany of victims who would be crying out for someone to bring justice to such an unjust city. Just the sheer quantity of victims that have had, that would have suffered at the hands of the Sodomites. There would just have been a litany of statistical abuse and injustice suffered in that city. So remember this. This wasn't an isolated incident in Sodom where men were violated. This was routine. This was a reputation that they have established for themselves. So God's action towards Sodom were carried out on behalf of victims. In fact, this passage makes this point at least three times when you look out for the word outcry. Have a look at these verses with me. Chapter 18, 20 to 21 records this for us. Then the Lord said, because of the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah, which is another city nearby, is great, and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And then again in chapter 19, verse 13, we are about to destroy this place because of the outcry against its people has become great before the Lord. And this outcry, Hebrew scholars tell us, was a cry of anguish and distress. It is a call for help from victims. Victims pleading for someone to come to their aid, to hear the wrongs that has been done against them and the injustice that they have suffered. And then for that someone not only to hear them, but to take up their cause, to make right what has been wronged. To which some of our more skeptical friends and neighbors might say, even if God does do that, isn't it a bit of overkill to wipe out a city? Isn't that disproportionate to the crime? I don't know about you, but if you can imagine or have known someone who has been acquainted with sexual violence, what would you consider to be an appropriate response? Whether you think God's response is just or not, I think we can all agree that a significant response is warranted. So my first point is this. By destroying Sodom, God was not acting out of a morbid obsession for charred flesh, as Richard Dawkins might imagine. Rather, God was taking up the cause of those victimized by sexual violence. Even so, some might imagine still that God is trigger happy, that he's just eager to pull on that lever of fire and brimstone on people. But is this true? Is this what our passage tells us that God is like? That he's got hand on the lever, ready at any violation to pull on that lever of judgment. Let's take a look. Genesis 18, verse 21. And the Lord is speaking at this point, and he says, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And if not, I will know. God's first reaction to the violence taking place at Sodom is not fire and brimstone, his first reaction is to go and find out whether all the cries of the victims stack up. Are things in Sodom as bad as people claim them to be? Is it really as perverse as the people say? At this point, I just want to remind you that when the Bible tells us things like this, of the Lord going down to a place to fact find, it is in no way meant to communicate to us that God does not already know the truth of Sodom. We believe in a God that knows all things, past, present, and future. The reason the passage records this for us with such detail that the Lord is on his way to fact find is for our benefit. It's so that we might learn about God's impeccable commitment to justice in the world. Added to this fact-finding mission of God, we also see a prolonged prayer of Abraham, right? When we read that a little bit earlier, just this repeated motions from Abraham, 50, 45, 30, 20, 10. He just keeps pleading with the Lord with this prolonged prayerful intervention on behalf of the city. He pleads with God to spare the whole city for the sake of 10 inhabitants, just 10 people in that whole city who opposed the collective rape crimes of the community. If just 10 such people could be found, then the city would be spared. So from these two facts, we know that God was not acting out of emotional overboil toward the situation like we sometimes do, right? When our emotion starts to drive our reactions to a situation, God is not like that. God is measured. We see this in this story. He is measured. He is in full control and possession of his desire for justice in the world. Further, the fact that God was willing to spare the whole city for the sake of 10 people, we know that God is not an indiscriminate, warmongering deity, as some often assume he is. To quote Richard Dawkins once more, he said, "The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak, and vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser, capriciously malevolent bully." That is how he thinks about God. The story of Sodom tells us this assumption about God is unwarranted. God's judgments, even in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, are not the actions of an indiscriminate deity who is petty and vindictive. Real violations of human dignity has occurred. People are pleading for justice to be restored in an unjust world. Their hope is in God to do so, and yet this God is so careful in dispensing his justice that he would not destroy the innocent along with the guilty. It seems to me that when we give this story a fair hearing, when we read carefully, the details tell us that God is not hasty to judge. He is not trigger happy, as some assume him to be. God took time to investigate. God heard the prayers of Abraham, even the pleas of Lot, one of the inhabitants there, to plead with the men to not act so wickedly. And even the blindness that they were struck with was not enough to deter them from their wickedness, right? After all this, after all these motions, after all this grace and patience with this city, after pleading with them in so many ways to stop their wickedness and violation and misuse of other people, after all that, all the options are exhausted. So anyone with sympathy for the victimized would gladly invite God to restore justice. I think you could feel that in your own being too. That repeat offenders, after you have tried everything with them, continue to insist on violating others, must be stopped. And so God will stop those perpetrators. He will oppose true evil in this world. It's paying attention to these details that relieves us of our very worst assumptions and opinions of who God is and what He is like. Maybe you've long held similar beliefs to Mr. Dawkins about who God is. You've suspected and dismissed God as a cruel bully. If so, can I challenge you to just look at the details of the message itself? Don't settle for snippets and fragments of information on which to inform your opinions of who God is and what He is like. Make an investigation of it. Look for details. Take into account the fullest story. Don't settle for hearsay that seeks to paint God in the worst possible light. That being so, where does this leave us this morning? If we concede that God does act on behalf of those victimized by true evil in the world, and if we concede that God is not as hasty and trigger-happy as we have often assumed Him to be, where does this leave you and I? What does this passage teach us? Two things. Firstly, if you have suffered at the hands of others, if you have been a victim of sexual crimes this way, this passage clearly tells you that God will not let those crimes slip over the edge of eternity unnoticed. Whether in this life or the next, God will act justly towards the perpetrators. Therefore, He is your secure hope. He is the true judge. He will come to your aid. He will make right what is wrong. Secondly, this passage also tells us that for those of us who have sinned against others, that the Lord is patient, seeking repentance from those who sin against others. He holds His hand out that you might repent and return to the goodness of the Lord. He did so with the city of Sodom. He is eager that you forsake the evil and embrace what is good. So in these two ways, whether we have been sinned against or whether we are the ones sinning against others, the Lord would have us learn something true and good about His nature and character, that He will come to your aid. He will act justly. He will extend His hand of patience for your repentance. But finally, there must be action. God is the judge of the whole earth, and he will do what is right.